Okay, let me begin the lecture today by reminding you about what the main point of the lecture was last time. Lecture last time was about essentially about 1945. The main point of that lecture was that the Cold War, which is going to be the focus of the whole second part of the course, it's profoundly puzzling, or at least it's puzzling when you bring a certain perspective to bear, a perspective grounded in international relations theory. The basic assumption that lies at the heart of that theoretical perspective, the realist perspective, is that power, the structure of power, is of absolutely fundamental importance in international political life. And the way this applies to the post-World War II world is, yes, it might have been the case that the Soviet Union would have loved to see its system spread throughout Europe, to communize all of Europe up to the Atlantic. But it wasn't going to pursue that policy if it would lead to a new world war and to a global conflict with a country as strong as the United States, a country which at this point in time was supremely powerful. Don't forget, Europe had been devastated in the war. The Soviet Union, Germany, Japan had been devastated. Whereas the war had not touched the United States. If anything, the military spending associated with the war pulled the United States out of the Great Depression of the 1930s and led to an extraordinary period of prosperity. Right? The result was that in terms of the distribution of industrial capacity, industrial production, the United States was at the height of its power relative to the rest of the world, stronger than it had ever been prior to that point, and stronger than it would ever be subsequent to that point as the economies of the rest of the world began to revive. Like fully 50% of world industrial production was accounted for by the United States. As though that weren't enough, the United States also enjoyed a nuclear monopoly. And it's like, the Soviets aren't going to go to war with a country like America if they could avoid it. On the other hand, the United States, which certainly would have loved to see democratic regimes spread throughout Europe, to see Poland and Czechoslovakia and Romania and Bulgaria and so on, all become democracies, we weren't going to go to war in order to achieve that result. You know, we had, had this astonishing victory in the Second World War. America was essentially a very secure country. It had no stomach for a Third World War against its, a former ally, the Soviet Union. You know, faced with the choice of, do you want to spread democracy throughout Europe, even if it means war, or are you willing to accept things as they are? You know, it's like open and shut. Of course, you would be happy to accept things as they are. So as a result of these power factors, right, each side was pulled toward a strategy of essentially being willing to accept the status quo, being willing to live with the division of Europe. Yeah. See, the power political realities discipline the ideology. America and Russia, both highly ideological countries, were forced pretty much by the fact that they had to deal with another very strong country in the system to pull in their horns and accommodate to the basic structure of power. American power, Soviet power, they balanced each other off very completely in the heart of Europe so that both sides were effectively locked into the status quo. All right? That's a theoretical perspective. But it generates this puzzle for us. If this is true, then how do you explain the Cold War? Why was it not the case that both sides understood from the very start what the situation was and said, all right, well, we may not like it all that much, but it's vastly preferable to a new war, so we're willing to live with it. No, you know, why should there be any fuss? But we know that there was a Cold War. There was this very sharp conflict that began in 1946. By the middle of 1946, the two sides are kind of screaming at each other. You have, you know, these famous events. Stalin gave a speech on February 9th, 1946, leading American figure, Supreme Court Justice William L. Douglas, referred to as a declaration of World War III. You may wonder, how do I remember that date? That happens to be the day that I was born. So it's like, I remember February 9th, 1946. A month later, Churchill gives his famous Iron Curtain speech, and I put the clip on the class website so you could listen to it if you like. It's only like 3 minutes long, you know. From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an Iron Curtain has descended over Europe. You know, it's like very powerful stuff. All right. You know, they're engaged in a war of words by the middle of 1946. Where does this come from? How do you explain it? And then once the kind of ball starts rolling, it just seems to kind of go on and on. Things kind of get worse around 1950, as we'll see. The Cold War becomes the dominant political fact for, you know, almost half a century. From 1946 to I'll say the Gorbachev period in the very late 1980s. How do you explain it? How do you explain it? Could it be that these people who say, "Oh, the Cold War is to be understood in ideological terms," it's very natural that a regime like Stalinist Russia and liberal America would engage in this kind of conflict? Could it possibly be that perspective is correct? Well, who knows? You know, the thing about theory is it doesn't tell you necessarily about the way things actually are. It defines the problem. See, it's puzzling. If you have a certain, if you have a grounding in a certain theoretical perspective, you know why you should have a conflict of this sort. Right. Yeah?
Since the U.S. was doing so well after, or because of World War II, and didn't want the war, why not go to war with Russia?
Did you hear that in the back of the room? She says, well, if the U.S. is so strong, why didn't they go to war with Russia? You know? Good question. And you'll see one of the readings is this thing I wrote called a Wasting Asset. It's for I think maybe it's for next week. It deals with this whole issue of preventive war. If Russia's going to be a problem for the United States in the long run, why don't we just deal with it? You just, you know, we have the nuclear monopoly. They don't have anything. We'll just destroy their cities, destroy the Soviet Union. Believe it or not, there were actually people who thought along those lines. But there are arguments against the two. And I don't mean simply the moral argument. And the moral argument is a powerful argument. It's very different to destroy the Russian population than it was to kind of drop bombs on the Germans or the Japanese during the Second World War. Why is it different? Because according to the U.S. ideology, these Soviet citizens are victims of the regime. They're people who suffer from the Stalinist regime. They're people we should have sympathy with. So you're going to destroy them just so that you could wipe out a rival state? Well, that's one thing. Number two is, where's the threat? Before you're going to go to something like a Third World War, Third World War is a serious undertaking, you have to be convinced that your fundamental interests are threatened in a very basic way. Well, where were they being threatened? Right. What was the Soviet Union actually doing? There's this whole notion that Stalinist Russia was a very aggressive state. And you say, where's the evidence? You show me where they were aggressive. They were opportunistic in certain ways, but the level of aggression of Stalinist Russia is nothing compared to Hitler. I mean, it's nothing even compared to Stalin's successor, Nikita Khrushchev, who was much more of a destabilizing force. I mean, that's another point about the preventive war. And then suppose you do it. Suppose you wipe out Russia. You think that's going to be the end of the problems? You think that political life is just going to stop after that? You know, how the Americans going to feel about themselves after they have engaged in what would have been a genocidal war, a war which could have easily led to more deaths than even Hitler had caused? Think through these kinds of issues. What are you going to do with all this territory that you've devastated? Are you just going to let it rot? You know, just walk away from it as a smoking, radiating ruin? Or don't you feel a certain obligation to kind of do something about it? You know, help reestablish some sort of political order there? I mean, there are a lot of reasons why, even if it were a theoretical possibility, you might not want it to engage in a preventive war. It goes on. You know, with those early atomic bombs, there's a limit to what you could do with them. There weren't too many of them. They were hard to build. They were hard to deliver. And they were very limited power. People think, oh, well, didn't the atomic bomb destroy Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Well, not quite. Like their streetcar system was back in operation just a few days after the nuclear explosion. This is Hiroshima. And also Japan is peculiarly vulnerable to nuclear attack because their cities are constructed of highly inflammable material in that period. An atomic bomb of the sort that was dropped on Hiroshima, what can it destroy? It destroys basically an area with maybe a radius of 1 mile, even less than that. Say the UCLA campus and adjoining areas of Westwood, right? Whereas the great thermonuclear explosives that came online around 1952, these are 1,000 times more powerful than the early atomic bombs. And once you master the technology, you can build, very large numbers of these things, and you can make them light enough to kind of carry in, with medium bombers or carrier-based fighter bombers. You don't have to rely on these huge intercontinental bombers. just maybe like two or three of these hydrogen weapons can destroy even the largest metropolitan areas like Los Angeles or New York or Moscow or whatever. You couldn't say that about the early atomic bombs. So your ability to win a war is... It's a more difficult undertaking than you think. It's not simply a question of pressing the button or giving the go code and so on. And then it goes on. You get involved in a war like this. What's going to happen to the people on your side of the line of demarcation? The mere fact that the United States had developed this sort of capability meant that we could demobilize relatively quickly. And there's this whole generation of Americans, basically my parents' generation here, who they had suffered, you know, through these really long, hard years of depression and war, you know, 30s and most of the 1940s. And they were in this mood to kind of move to the suburbs and start having children as the post-war baby boom. And you know, enjoy some of the simple pleasures of life. You know, get cars and refrigerators, and a few years later, television. You know, this is they were in no mood to kind of sanction a large military establishment, and so basically, what this meant was that the American nuclear monopoly was balanced by a Soviet conventional superiority in the continent of Europe. So that if we unleashed a war, oh yeah, the Soviet Union would be destroyed in the long run. But they'd overrun Western Europe, and Western Europe, in fact, would be destroyed also in the course of that war, because if only by American bombs, because the Soviets would try and harness the resources of Western Europe to their war machine, and therefore we would be obliged to bomb them, just as France, for example, had been bombed in World War II for that very reason, by Britain and America. It's not... When you start thinking about it, it's not a very enticing prospect. Although there were people who made this kind of argument, we'll see. I'll come back to this issue because it's an important issue. Well, you know, I'd say, why is this an important issue? Because this whole issue of preventive war deserves to be taken more seriously than you think. A lot of people think, oh, a country like the United States would never even consider a preventive war. We only go to war when we ourselves are attacked, or upon the most severe provocation. It was only this terrible George W. Bush who broke with this great American tradition of virtue in international politics who actually contemplated preventive war. And that's why the Iraq War is so bad. You know, you hear these ideas bandied about, and it turns out like so much stuff that's said when political issues are sort of discussed, it just doesn't capture the essence of what U.S. policy was and the basic structural imperatives that you see at work, one of which is a certain interest in acting preventively like that. We'll come back to these things, I promise. It's a good question. All right. The puzzle of the Cold War. We know there was a Cold War. How do you get at that whole issue of how it's to be explained? Well, the standard way is you look at the historical record. You know, could it be the people who interpreted the Cold War in ideological terms were right? That this explains what, from a realist point of view, is an anomaly? It turns out, no. When you look at the historical record, instead of helping you resolve the puzzle, it actually deepens the puzzle, right? This is the point I was trying to make at the end of the lecture last time. It deepens the puzzle. Why? Because the leaders, the real policymakers on both sides, tended to think in realist terms, spheres of influence terms. Let's divide Europe. You control things on your side of the line. We'll control things on our side of the line. We can get together on that basis. What's the proof for that claim? A lot of people find it hard to accept this is the case. You know, the proof basically turns on the records of the Potsdam Conference, which were published in 1960, almost by accident. You know why they were published? Because the Republicans had gotten into their heads that President Roosevelt had sold out Poland at Yalta, that President Roosevelt had opted for a policy of appeasement of the communists at Yalta, and then when the Republicans took control of Congress in the 1952 elections, they passed legislation saying that the State Department's historical office was going to have to publish all the records of the Yalta Conference, and then for kind of good measure, the way this stuff often works in Congress, someone said, and all the other wartime conferences too. So in addition to Yalta, they published the records of the Tehran and Potsdam Conferences. The records of the Potsdam Conference came out in 1960. It's one of the most extraordinary collections of documents I've ever read. And one of the extraordinary things about it is that the whole historical profession had essentially ignored the contents of this document, of this collection of documents. As I say, the key thing about Potsdam was the Burns Plan, for German reparations. Right? Because the whole idea of the Burns Plan was, they take what they want from their part of Germany, we and our friends will take what we want from our part of Germany. The implication of that was that Germany's foreign trade could not be managed on a unitary basis, but only on a zonal basis. If Germany were to be run as a unitary economy, as a single economy, then Germany's foreign trade would have to be run on a unitary basis. If it were done on a zonal basis, then the two parts of Germany would have to relate to each other as foreign countries, as countries engaged in international trade, or actually, more precisely, international barter. It couldn't be run. So the implication of the zonal agreement for the reparations was not just that a unitary arrangement for foreign trade was ruled out, but also that the whole German economy could not be run on a unified basis, but rather there would be it would be split into these two parts. And the what goes on in the economic sphere basically foreshadows what's going to happen in the political sphere. And there are specific mechanisms why this is the case, because the first organisms of a new German state would come into being as administrative structures designed to run the economy rather than to engage in more purely political activities, which the Allies didn't want to quite let the Germans do at that point yet. Okay, so that's the Burns Plan, very significant. It suggests the spheres of influence concept. Stalin buys into this thing. He takes the lead in extending it to include a plan for the divvying up of Germany's foreign assets, very much based on this notion of the Soviets get the East, the America and her friends get the West. It wasn't just Burns, just kind of going off on his own. This was very much in line with the basic policy that was in place even before Burns took office in the middle of 1945. Proof being that Truman, after his initial hard line, quickly backtracked in May, sent Harry Hopkins off to Moscow, and the Hopkins mission essentially was tantamount to American acceptance of a Soviet-dominated regime, a communist regime for Poland. They wanted to settle the Polish issue. They wanted to get along with the Soviets. They didn't want a conflict with the Soviets. We didn't care about Poland. And then you see the policy actually continuing through the second half of 1945. Again, there's another big surprise that Burns wanted to kind of cut this deal with the Soviets. And there was a conference at London of foreign ministers in September, and Burns keeps saying over and over again to the Soviets, look, Poland's been settled. We're happy with the way Poland's been settled. Let's take that as a model for how we could settle the rest of Eastern Europe, meaning basically Bulgaria and Romania, two big issues there. Let's settle Bulgaria and Romania the same way we settled Poland. Namely, it was very clear by that point that what he meant was a communist-dominated regime. But it wasn't just a gift, an act of appeasement, pure and simple, or desire to kind of cut a deal as an end in itself, because the United States was getting a lot from this. What were we getting? Number one, the Soviets, just as we were disengaging from Eastern Europe and agreeing to allow the Soviets to dominate Eastern Europe, they would agree to allow us to dominate Western Europe. Not just Western Germany, but countries like Italy as well. Okay? And then the other big prize for the West was Japan. The United States was out. You know, don't forget, the Soviets had been neutral for practically the entire war, and the war against Japan. They came in only at the end. But we wouldn't let them take part in the occupation of Japan. As a matter of fact, we didn't want anyone else to play a significant role in the occupation of Japan. We had fought this war. We had beaten the Japanese. We were going to control Japan ourselves. All right, but we wanted the Soviets to kind of give their okay to that. And they did, and in exchange basically for our giving our okay to a settlement for Eastern Europe that favored them. You know, this is the meaning of U.S. policy in the last few months of 1945, culminating in an agreement that Burns and Stalin reach at a Moscow conference in December of 1945. You know, which related both to Bulgaria and Romania and also to Japan, right? Straight spheres of influence sort of agreement. And it's quite striking because everyone says, oh, neither Stalin wouldn't accept this, the Americans wouldn't accept this. And here you have, you know, very clear evidence that both sides are willing to accept this, right? This doesn't solve our problem. It deepens the problem. It brings the problem to even sharper focus. If both sides wanted to do this, if both sides understood the basic logic of the situation, were really willing to accommodate to that. Why did they just agree to a spheres of influence peace then and there? Okay, very important question. Why is this question important? Because it bears on the whole issue of how you can have international conflict even if nobody really wants it. Right. I mean, it's very easy to explain a war if you have really aggressive countries like Nazi Germany. And the simple fact that it's easy to explain means it's not terribly interesting intellectually. The really interesting issues intellectually are these issues about how you can have a war if no one really wants it. And that's why is why I think the Cold War is just so much more interesting than the pre-1939 period. Okay. So you look at the evidence. What does the evidence show? Well, far from being the innocent Americans reacting to an increasingly aggressive Soviet policy, the key change takes place on the U.S. side. The whole Burns policy at Potsdam of allowing the Soviets to call the shots in Eastern Germany, and especially to deal with reparations in Eastern Germany on a zonal basis, the core of the Burns plan. Now the Americans start calling for a unitary arrangement for dealing with these economic issues in general and for the reparations in particular. A unitary plan for managing German foreign trade. A complete contradiction of what American policy had been at Potsdam. It's the Americans who change, right? And there are some key steps in that process. Right, these demands kind of begin even in late 1945. I should say, why do you have this? Well, to a certain extent, you could try and understand it in bureaucratic politics terms. The American military governor, General Clay, Lucius Clay, he's not privy to the terms of the Potsdam Accord. Right. He was not. They saw the final version of the Potsdam Protocol, but he was not allowed to see the records of the meetings at Potsdam, which would allow you to understand what the real policy was. So all he had to go on was the formal agreement. the formal agreement, you can interpret it as calling for Germany to be run on a unitary basis. Because, but that was essentially a face-saving device. No one wanted to say, oh, we want to divide Germany. Everyone wanted to pretend, oh, we're in favor of, organizing the world on the basis of nation states, and Germany is clearly a nation state, right? They didn't want to say it. So in the agreement itself, it said, well, these various commissions should try and do X, Y, and Z. But the reservation at the Potsdam Conference is, yeah, we'll put this in, but this is only going to work if those different bodies, the Allied Control Commission for Germany, reach agreement. But they're not going to reach agreement. They're going to deadlock, in which case the authority is going to revert to the zonal commanders, and the United States will be able to work out deals with the British and the French, and we could run West Germany on a West-only basis. And that was the real understanding of the people who drafted the Potsdam Agreement, but they stuck the stuff in the agreement. The American authorities in Germany, however, took the agreement at face value and pressed the Soviets to agree to arrangements for running Germany as a unit. And when the Germans didn't, and when the Soviets didn't go along with this, then the Americans get all upset and they start condemning the Soviets. And as a matter of fact, in April of 1946, General Clay suspends the delivery of these reparations from the Western Zone to Germany, which they had been entitled to under the Potsdam Agreement. His argument is, well, they're not complying with their part of the Potsdam Agreement about running Germany as a unit, so we shouldn't have to comply with ours either. And so the Americans basically walk away from Potsdam and are reclaiming their freedom of action. July 1st, 1946, they propose to merge their zone with whatever other zone is willing to work with them. The British say yes. This leads to the creation of the Bi-Zone, or Bizonia as sometimes called. Comes into being at the very beginning of 1947. And the whole idea here is you're moving ahead toward the creation of a political structure for West Germany, for ultimately what would become a West German state. But this is the last thing that the Soviets want. And because they're afraid that if West Germany becomes too strong, that would pose a great threat to them, and in particular to their control over East Germany, and that the Soviets, for their part, want to head this off. And so they start trying to outbid the Western powers for the allegiance of the West Germans. Molotov, Soviet foreign minister, gives an important speech in, I think it was August of 46, and Secretary Burns responds with a very important speech at Stuttgart in September of 1946, that basically holding up some hope for the Germans that if they work with the West, they'll be able to find a way out of their present misery, a way not just toward economic prosperity, but also toward a degree of political autonomy, maybe even full independence. Okay. There's this process going on. Why did Burns allow Clay to pursue that policy? It wasn't simply a question of Clay, moving ahead on his own. Why did Burns so allow this sort of thing to go on? Well, he had a domestic political interest in not revealing what his real thinking was. He was too much of a realist for the American political system. He had to pretend to pursue a more Wilsonian sort of policy. That's the initial rationale, I think, for why Burns did this sort of thing. Let Clay do his thing. After a while, he'll realize that it's hopeless. The Soviets will never give him what he wants. And then they'll come around to seeing that there's really no alternative to the Burns strategy of, the amicable divorce. The two sides going their separate ways in peace. Let the Soviets control their part of Germany, but we're going to control our part of Germany. Right? He didn't intend this to be the basis for a political attack on the Soviets when the policy was initially put into place at the end of 1945. But it served that purpose because the entire political conjuncture had changed in early 1946 for reasons having nothing to do with Germany. For reasons having to do with a different part of the world that lay somewhat to the southeast of Germany. And by that I mean, of course, the Middle East, and I mean Soviet pressure on Turkey and Iran, which began in 1945 and culminated, reached a climax in 1946, early 1946. Soviets wanted to get control of the Turkish Straits. Stalin was quite upfront about comparing himself to the Czars. He says to the Western powers at Potsdam, to the British and the Americans. You know, it says the West was willing to allow Tsarist Russia during World War I. It accepted its right to take control of the Turkish Straits. And so why won't you give a Soviet regime what you were willing to give the Tsars? Right. And he says, aren't we entitled to a control of a waterway of equivalent importance to our own security from what you guys have? You Americans, you control the Panama Canal. You British, you control the Suez Canal. Your justification for that is purely strategic. Say, why shouldn't we have the same? Now, this is the Stalin argument at Potsdam. And the American policy, as the Soviets begin putting more and more pressure on the Turks and concentrating forces on the Turkish border in Bulgaria and conducting, a propaganda war against Turkey and apparently preparing for military action, you know, setting up field hospitals and so on. The American attitude is first, well, there's nothing we could do. We don't have an interest in that part of the world. It's too bad for the Turks, but they'll be crushed by the Soviets the same way that the Finns were crushed in 1939. And then American policy starts to shift. And then by January of 1946, the Americans reach the conclusion, no, this is not tolerable. We're willing to accept the Soviet sphere as it existed at the end of the war, but that far and no further. Right? This is what's called the containment doctrine. And there's this great myth that the containment policy was a product of the thinking of our old friend George Kennan. And George Kennan wrote an important article laying out the containment policy and providing a rationale for it, an article that came out in 1947. But it's important to understand that the policy is essentially already in place before Kennan came on the scene. It's a very natural policy. It's like, you know, we achieved this victory in the Second World War at considerable cost, and we have a right to the fruits of that victory. Here we are in Western Europe. You know, we're not going to be kicked out. We're not going to allow all of that area to be turned over to a not-so-friendly regime like Stalinist Russia. And as for these other areas, you know, the basic principle has to be, unless you're willing to just kind of give away everything in dribs and drabs, we got to draw the line. That thus far and no further. So American policy toward Turkey in 1946 hardens, and the Soviets draw back. As soon as they understand there's any risk of war with the United States, oh boy, they're gonna, you know, pull back. The same sort of thing, but in a much more public way, in Iran, also in the spring of 1946. Iran had been occupied by the three major Allied powers during the war, because this was a very important channel for the providing of the Soviets with lend-lease goods from the United States. The promise was that the three occupying powers would pull out of Iran within 6 months after the end of the war. And it's becoming increasingly clear, not just that the Soviets were not going to keep that promise, but they were going to use that military presence there to create kind of satellite regimes in the part of Iran they occupied, northern Iran and Iranian Azerbaijan. And once again, the Americans take a very tough line, and once again, the Soviets draw back in the face of American pressure. Okay? Right? Why is this important? Well, you say this is just a little dispute over where the line of demarcation should be drawn. We know where it's drawn in Europe. Now we're extending it to the southern frontier of the Soviets. You know, the conflict of whatever disputes there were in 1945 meant that Eastern Europe would be part of the Soviet sphere. Now these disputes over Iran and Turkey in 1946 meant that those countries would be in the Western sphere. End of story. The issue is settled. Why don't you have peace now? The answer there is that the whole Iran and Turkey business had an importance that went beyond its purely regional significance. It had an importance in reshaping American thinking about how to deal with the Soviets. The initial hope of Burns at Potsdam was, we can make a deal with these people. We could settle all these things in a relatively friendly way. The peace would not rest solely on naked military power. It could be more consensual. Right? That's why we're willing to pay a price. We're willing to sweeten the pot for them in various ways. Okay? But now it's becoming clear that no, the only thing that they respect is force. You need to be willing to use force to kind of keep them at bay. That's the lesson that's drawn from the Middle Eastern crises or Near Eastern crises of the spring of 1946. We got to be tough. You know, military power can't just be in the deep background. It has to be overt. And how are you going to do that given the attitude of the American people? Well, you got to sell them on the importance of a tough line by exaggerating how awful the Soviets are. By portraying the Soviets as much more aggressive than they in fact were. You have to make things, and this is, I think, a notorious expression. It's from then Undersecretary of State Dean Acheson. He said, you got to make things clearer than the truth. See, this is the price we pay for being a democracy. See, the American people aren't going to understand a kind of subtle political analysis based on the balance of power and so on. They insist on viewing these things in starker, black or white, moralistic terms. We gotta kind of blacken the Soviets and make them out as worse than they in fact are, as a move directed not against them, but against our own people. We gotta convince our own people that these are issues worth fighting for. You know, we gotta mobilize our own people. All right. I should say, this is not just the theory. There's a lot of evidence showing that these people were talking along those lines. All right. But American opinion, to a certain extent, British opinion, they're not the only targets here in this policy. The other major target is the German people. Okay, we demobilize after the war, but we keep a relatively small occupation force in Germany. You know, it's like, how are you going to control an area of 45 million people just western Germany with such a small force? The answer is you can't. Ultimately, you need the Germans to kind of come over to your side. And how do you get the Germans to come over to your side if you pursue your policy aimed at the division of their country? So you got to pretend that you're in favor of a unified Germany. You got to pretend that you support German national goals. And so how do you explain the division of Germany? It's all the Soviets' fault, right? So the campaign of blaming the Soviets is also directed at bringing the Germans up, okay? Now, There's a these are not simply short-term calculations. There's a long-term strategy in place, right? It's not the strategy of containment. That's kind of an obvious thing to do. It's what's called the Western strategy for Germany. The Western strategy for Germany. Already implicit at Potsdam, and it becomes explicit in 1946. What is the Western strategy for Germany? It's the idea that Western Germany, the three Western zones, would be organized first economically, then politically, and ultimately militarily, under the auspices of the three Western powers, that West German entity, eventually a state, would be tied into the Western world in all kinds of ways, economically, culturally, politically, ultimately militarily, right? That's a strategy that had to be chosen. It wasn't obvious and instinctive the way containment was. But what it meant was that a certain process was triggered. A process was triggered that led to permanent tension. Yeah?
Was this before or after the blockade?
The Berlin blockade? Oh, this is Berlin blockade is 1948. I'm talking about 1946 now. Okay, a process is set in motion. What is this process? Okay, we want to win the Germans over to our side, so we got to play up to them, and playing up to them means underwriting their national goals, giving them more and more in the way of autonomy, as the price that we're paying to them for their aligning themselves with us, right? And that means that we got to blame the Soviets for all the problems. We're implying to the Germans that we will support you in your efforts to achieve the reunification of your own country. We will underwrite your national goals. Now, from the Soviet standpoint, what does this mean? So dealing with a resurgent West Germany would be bad enough. But dealing with a West Germany that's supported by the Western powers, indeed a West Germany that the Western powers have to support, lest they lose the West Germans, that would be even worse, because West Germany would have the ability to pull the West as a whole, including America with all its power, into a war with the Soviet Union over the reunification of Germany. Right, so the Soviets have a strong incentive to preempt that, to prevent that from happening, to maybe take a softer line vis-a-vis the Germans, and that's what we saw, that's what they were doing. That's the meaning of that Molotov speech I mentioned. The Americans, on the other hand, are worried that the Germans may give in to those Soviet blandishments. And so that means that we have to up the ante and increase the price that we're going to pay to the Soviets, to the Germans. The Soviets see this, and you have this cycle that takes place. For those of you who have had any exposure to international relations theory, you probably have heard of the notion of the security dilemma. As I say, a very important concept developed in our own department by Robert Jervis when he was an assistant professor here. This is a case of the security dilemma in action. No one wants war, but countries, both the United States and the Soviet Union, both of whom have essentially defensive goals to maintain the status quo, are led to adopt policies that the other will necessarily see as threatening. The more we support West Germany, the more threatening the Soviet Union will have to become to kind of give us an incentive to wait a minute and maybe negotiate this thing. But the more threatening the Soviets become, the more of an interest we have in bringing the Germans over to our camp. You have a spiral dynamic taking place during this period. Okay, that's 1946. Burns is out by the beginning of 1947 for reasons that have nothing to do with his substantive policy. It's a personal thing. And it's replaced by General Marshall, General George Marshall. Marshall doesn't like this stuff at all. He doesn't like the Western strategy and the whole idea of burning your bridges with the Soviets. And he makes this big effort in 1947 to see if he could work out things with that. He goes over, it spends like 2 months in this big conference in Moscow in the spring of 1947. You know, can't do it. Comes back, they come up with what was to become the Marshall Plan, which is basically directed at rehabilitating Western Europe and integrating Western Europe into the Western Bloc. Matters go from bad to worse. By the end of 1947, even Marshall, at the London Conference, December 1947, important conference because it marks the break between Russia and the Western powers. Even Marshall comes to realize that the effort to reach an accommodation with the Soviets is hopeless. And they opt for the policy of establishing a West German state, a crucial development in the post-war period, something the Soviets are bound to view as threatening. And this is what leads to the Berlin Blockade Affair of 1948-49. So I'm going to break off here now. And that's where we're going to pick up the story next time with the London Conference, December of 47, and the events of 48-49. Okay.